interview with Barney and Ole Hansen in Eagle, Colorado, or Eagle, Alaska, July 27th, 1976. First of all, Barney, maybe you could tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was born in St. Helena, California, 1894, September the 28th, in the St. Helena Sanitarium, Napa County, California. And my mother was born and raised in Auckland, New Zealand. And when I become about 7 years old, we went to Australia on account of my mother's health. And we were in Australia about 3 years, and her health became worse. She had tuberculosis. And we come back to the United States and went to Southern California. And we lived in the San Bernardino Valley for little over 3 years, close to 4 years. And every summer we'd go up in the San Bernardino Mountains on the backside, close to the desert country, but up in the mountains still. We weren't what they call that desert now, that that's north of the range there, or east of it. So I guess close to the Mojave Desert, but still in the San Bernardino Mountains. And my mother got well, and we had, in the meantime, we had lost my father. And we went back to Auckland, New Zealand, and I lived there till I was 16 years old. And then I either had to become a British subject or go back to the United States. So I come back to the United States by myself. I didn't want to. I had an idea that if I become a British subject, I was never an American anymore. And I was proud I was an American. And you know, when you're in a foreign country, even if you're a kid, you'll get into scraps with other kids over your country. And I had backed up my country been quite a few times while I was in New Zealand. And I'd done pretty good about coming up on top most of the time. And I come back to the United States by myself, landed in Seattle, Washington. First, we stopped at Victoria, B.C., and I took a ferry boat. I think it's still in operation. It was the it was a little three-masted, three-funnel, fast ferry boat from Vancouver and Victoria and down to Seattle. And you remember what it was? Not Hazel. I keep wanting to call it the Hazel, but it was Princess Louise, I think was the name of it. And I have been on it since too. And that time, but that first summer, I finally got a job raking rocks on the county road in Yakima County. I got in Seattle, there was nothing for a kid, and a fella told me, he said, you know, he says, young fella, he says, you ought to go over to Yakima, around Yakima. He says, they're starting to raise quite a few apples. And he says, you look like you could climb apple trees pretty good, thinning apples. So I went over and I said, I walked the roads, and I did. But everybody was just through with their thinning apples. But I come to one place, and the fella said, he was through thinning apples too. And I said, well, it seems like everybody's through with apples. I'd like to get some kind of work. And he said, well, he says, I believe, young fella, he says, I've got a job for you. He said, you look like a good skookum kid, skookum young fella. Well, skookum, I didn't know what that meant. And I asked him what skookum meant. And he said, oh, you're a good, strong boy. So I blowed up how stout I was and stuff, you know. And I did. I worked that summer until thrashing time on the county road, raking rocks out of the road, because at that time there was no automobiles. There was all horses and wagons and buggies and stuff. And I said they didn't like the horses walking over rocks and stuff, that the sheep would knock down the road and stuff, and there was lots of sheep in that country too. And that's what I did. Then I got a job on the thrash. The fellow that hired me, he said, you know, he says, this here work that you're doing, he says, we're just allowed so much money every year for this raking rocks. And he said, their budget is just about used up. So he said, if you can find work someplace, he says, I'd advise you to take it. Well, I said that the thrashing outfit wanted me to go to work on it. Well, he says, that's fine. He says, you do. So I did. And one of them farmers there in the valley I had seen a few times, and he said he'd always stop and talk a little, you know. But I said I didn't kill much time. I'd keep right on raking rocks even while he was trying to talk. And he had the nicest buggy of any of the farmers in the valley. He had a nice rubber-tired and wire-wheel buggy. Pretty fancy rig. And I went to work for that man after the thrashing was over. And I worked for him for years. He was one of the finest men I ever met in my life. Bob Cameron was his name. And I said, eventually, I went to the First World War from his place. And in the summertime, he raised alfalfa mostly, always. Most was his crop was alfalfa. And when you get the first cutting of hay up, why, there was nothing, you'd irrigate the land, and then there was nothing to do until the second cutting was ready. Well, first we'd take a trip in the mountains with pack horses and stuff, you know, and we'd go up the head of the little Winass Valley that we lived on, and we'd keep right on it going and come around out down by Mount Adams and down by Golden Dale, and then we'd follow the old air trail back home up to the Winass Valley. And so one summer we didn't do that. But he said, you very nice young fella, he says, why don't you take a trip over to Seattle or something? He says, it might do you good, look around a little. And I said, his wife was going over to Idaho to see a couple of sisters she had over there. And he said that he'd stay home and milk the cows and look after stuff while we'd all gone. So I went over to Seattle, and I went up to Victoria and went back. And in the little hotel I was staying in, the little old Diller Hotel on the corner of Second and University, there was a fellow and his wife was going to go to Skagway. So I said, I got to looking into it, and he said, well, why don't you come along with us? We're going to Skagway, and he says, don't take long. And so I went with him. And when I got to Skagway, why, it wasn't The train was going on to Whitehorse the next day, and it go over and back. And so I went over that first time and went to Whitehorse. And then I went back home. And then from then on, I used to go further.
What was the first year that you came to Alaska?
Well, the first year was 1915.
That was when you made that first trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I met an old fella in Yakima that was from here at Eagle. And, well, I'd already met a fella from Eagle. His name was, the old blacksmith.
Samus?
Oh, no, not just Samus, no. The one who was ahead of him, Matt Hoffman, the old blacksmith at the post here. When the post closed down here, he went out and he went to work eventually for the Yakima County Road Department. And I met him. Then I met old, through him, I met old Bert Bryant, who mined up on the 70 mile at Alder Creek. And first one thing another, and I eventually, by gosh, got located right here at Eagle on 70 mile with old Bert Bryant. Yeah, and first I was gone 3 years too to the war, you see, and I didn't get to come up or anything. And after the war, why, I come back up again. And right after that is when I met old Bert. Yeah, and then I come back up and went up out there on the 70 mile with old Bert. Yeah, he said, if you ever want to come up, he says, just look up old Bert. So I wrote, and I'd been corresponding with the old fella, and I come in on the first boat in 1929, and I quit the Union Oil Company and come right straight here to Eagle. Yeah, got off, was on the first boat down the river. But I'd got kind of halfway acquainted around Whitehorse before that. Yeah, old Fred Gray, he was in the powerhouse there, run the little, by that's quite a powerhouse there in Whitehorse those days. It had a little old single cylinder Corliss steam engine, you know, and he fired the boiler and looked after the power plant and everything, you know. And they fired the boiler with wood. And there's a fella in town here right now, Al Stout. You know Al. Well, Al Stout used to cut wood in the wintertime up there at Whitehorse when he was working on that Marsh Lake Dam. Yeah, and in the wintertime he'd cut wood for the power plant up there. And he was there for about 3 years, I think, before he come down here working on for the... And last I knew, the money he made up there was put in the Whitehorse Bank, and he never touched it.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's still there. I'm not sure, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. One time, when the first store, Safeway store, opened up in Fairbanks, we went to the opening evening, and in the store, we met Tom Downs, the NC manager. And I introduced Mom to him. And he was with his wife. And he introduced me. I knew she was, but I'd never been formally introduced to her. And he introduced me to her. And after he got through, he said, oh, yes. He said, by the way, he said, Barney's one of the old miners in the country. And he says, and he's one of the two that always paid his bills. Well, you know, I wondered for quite a long time. I wondered who the other one was. So one time I was sitting down and I went up there and I thought, by gosh, this time I'm going to come right out and ask Tom Downs who that other one was. And I said, you remember, Tom, I said that when you introduced me to your wife there in Fairbanks at the Safeway store at that opening evening? Yeah, he says, I do. Well, I said, you made a remark about me being in one of the old miners in the country, and you said that I was one of the two that had always paid his bills. And I said, would it be all right for you to tell me who the other one is? I said, I'd kind of like to know. He says, no, he says, your good friend Al Stout.
Yeah.
So I feel kind of proud of that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oleg, would you like to tell me a little bit about your background and where you were born and when you were born and a little about your childhood before you came to Alaska?
You've got a good one.
Well, I was born in Norway in 1897. And my mother and I lived together for about 2 years. My father was drowned when I was about 9 months old, so I didn't know him. But after 2 years, my father had a brother, an older brother, that had come to the United States earlier, and he came back to Norway to see his people, you know, and he asked Mother to come to the States with him. And so he went back to the United States, and finally Mother and I came over. And
where did you live when you came to the States?
North Dakota. But I like North Dakota. I like Alaska better than that. But anyhow, I didn't win. My father farmed in North Dakota, and he had to go pretty easy at first because money wasn't so easily made. And just in farming, you know, and of course you start out on a small scale, but the first year or so we lived in a sod house, complete sod, but it was nice and warm, real comfortable. And then after
just rose.
He finally was able to get enough.
Enough
lumber to build a frame house, and we thought we were pretty fortunate.
I got you some berries
tonight.
What you call?
And I had a sister that was born.
What you call these berries? Yeah. Oh,
that's those little blank caps. Her father had a steamer of his own that he used to take down in the Mediterranean, and he got fruit down there, and he'd load up this boat with fruit and take it to Sweden and Norway and England and sell that fruit. Well, in one of those big North Atlantic North Sea storms, all hands and ship and everything went down. There wasn't anybody saved or anything of the kind. It was one of those big, heavy storms, and we've never heard from them since. Nothing. Yeah.
Well, anyhow, we settled down there in our new home, which we thought was quite elegant. But before that, maybe I should have told you about our first Christmas in North Dakota. Father had managed to get four horses, one little driver, and the others were workhorses, and we lived 40 miles from the nearest shopping center. And in the middle of winter, just before Christmas, he went to Langdon, which was the name of the town, to get some supplies and some Christmas, something for Christmas. And he had those horses and one cow in the barn, and of course you never were sure just what the weather was going to be like, you know, or whether you'd be able to get back the same at the time that you expected to. And he told Mother, he says, he cut chunks of snow, blocks of snow, and put in each underneath each manger for the horses to eat on in case he didn't get back in time to water them. And of course put lots of hay in the mangers, and then he left and said he'd be back the next day, and if not the next day, it'd be the third. But he expected to be back the next day. Well, he'd been gone about 4 hours when the sky became very heavy and overcast, and Mother began to stew about it. And sure enough, here was a snowstorm, and a good one. It lasted for 3 days, and by the time he was able to get back, the little sod that was in the sod house, and the sod house was completely covered. And talk about being snowbound, as we were. And when Dad finally did come, we were running out of fuel. We had plenty of fuel, but it was outside. And Mother was trying to figure out which piece of furniture to cut up first to put in the wood stove. Well, she didn't have to. She had a kerosene, a little kerosene stove of some kind. I don't remember just what it was. But she kept using that for heat as well as to cook on, you know. Then all of a sudden, after the fourth day, we could hear the horses on the ice, or on the snow drift, you know. And
there's Bobby Jr. be out there, I guess, with his wife, and I don't know where that other Indian is with me.
Because he almost drove the team on top of the, all he could see was the stovepipe and snow all around. And, but he came so close to the sod house, you know, with the team and the sled, that we thought he was almost driving over it, but he wasn't. And before he got stopped, he called my mother's name. And of course, Mother, she was so happy she couldn't answer me. And as soon as he got down and off the sled, he started shoveling the snow away from the door. And everything was like okay. Yeah. But then he took the animals out to water them, and the first one was his little driver. He took her out to water, and I guess she drank too fast and she dropped right there. But the rest of them, they were okay. Well, that was almost Christmas, and my father didn't have much money to spare, but he brought the Sears Roebuck catalog for me to look at. Of course, I thought it was great. And then he had a bag of these old-fashioned peppermint candies.
Yeah.
And of course, that was great to get peppermint candies.
Yeah.
But her mother never cared for them. Later on, why he found out what kind she liked, and he brought her those chocolate-covered cherries after that.
That's what she liked.
When he could get them. But What time is it getting to be?
Oh, there's lots of time yet.
It's about four.
Well, I promised I'd make the soup for supper.
Maybe you can tell me how you decided to come to Alaska.
Oh. Yeah. I went to, I decided to go to school in Chicago to the Moody Bible Institute and take up some, I graduated from another school and I wanted to take up some music, vocal music. And I found just what I wanted there and enjoyed the place. But I met a girl that had been up here to Alaska, spent several years in Alaska, out around Bethel. And she was so interested in Alaska that she, every spare moment she had, she talked Alaska to us. She's a very fine person. She'd had smallpox when she was a child, and her face was badly pitted, but she was a real fine character, beautiful eyes. And she finally told me, she says, Borghild, that's my real name, is Borghild, and she says, you're just the type for Alaska. I want you to come to Alaska. So I finally made out an application for a teacher up here, and got answer back saying they had no vacancies at the time, but they would be holding my application, and if there was an opening, they'd consider me. So I was working schools out, and I was working in Marshall Field's drug department. But after a couple of months of that, I had about enough, and I thought, oh, how nice it is back in North Dakota. And it was just about harvest time, you know, I always enjoyed the harvest time. So I decided to go back home for a while. And I'd been there only about 10 days, I guess, or something like that, when a telegram came from the BIA in Seattle. And they said that they had an opening at Eagle, and if I was still interested, to just come right on. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't told my folks about this. I told them about this friend, but I hadn't told them that I had applied. Mother, she said, oh, that's so far away. My dad says it isn't as far as China, and I had planned on going to China when the time was ripe. But Dad says, well, I like that better than China. So he was pleased with it, you know. If I was going to go anywhere, well, this, that seemed to be the best. So that night, before we went to bed, Dad says, well, are you going to Alaska? And I said, I can't tell you yet, but I'll tell you in the morning. And so I prayed about it, and it seemed to me that I had the answer right there. And I went to bed and I was happy I was going to Alaska.
What year was that?
That was 1925.
Yep.
So, in a week's time, I was ready to go to Seattle and see the steamer. My father and mother were both so helpful in getting me things that they thought I needed, and especially warm underwear, long warm underwear, which I wore, I think, about twice before, after I got here. But when I got to Seattle and met all the BIA people, I enjoyed them all, and there was a young man that was going up at the same time to Ketchikan and to start the high school at Metlakatla. So, but when I started up the gangplank on the steamboat, what in the world am I doing? But I figured that others had gone ahead of me and I should be able to go too.
Yeah.
Oh. Why, the last boat had already gone downriver. And so they told her that there wouldn't be any boat. She'd have to take a little small boat that was only going to go as far as 40 mile. And from 40 mile on, they weren't sure just how she would get down, but...
in Dawson.
Oh, yeah.
One night in Dawson and the next day.
Mm-hmm.
There was an old couple there taking care of the road house. And Mrs. Schultz, I think her name was.
Mm-hmm.
Their name was Schultz. And she was pretty much crippled up with arthritis. And I was able to help her and spend the time while I was there. Waiting for the only means of getting down was the mailman from Dawson to Eagle, and then the world is going down. But you perhaps heard of Percy DeWolf?
No.
Sometimes, well, he carried the mail for 40 years altogether, and he would drive. Carry the mail in the fall after the steamer quit running. He had his own little launch and he'd carry the mail and a passenger or two.
What was his name again?
Percy DeWolf.
DeWolf?
Mm-hmm. Percy DeWolf, called the Iron Man of the North.
And he carried the mail from
Dawson.
Dawson.
And then there was another carrier that carried it from here on down the circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But after we had left 40 Mile and on our way down here, we saw the steamer coming back. The steamer that I should have come down on, it was coming back.
The steamer Yukon.
Yukon.
Yeah. See, she made a round trip every 10 days, the steamer Yukon did, from Dawson to Nenana and back to Dawson again. Every 10 days her schedule was in the summer. Well, it's a fine boat too, the finest boat on the river.
Well, anyhow, I got on with Percy DeWolf, and he was one of these fellows with a great big voice and a big laugh. So we met the steamer and then came on past that, and I thought, my, that's an elegant boat. But as we got down here by the village, he says, I think I'll let you off here. This is where you're going to be living. I guess I looked kind of frightened or something. And there was a whole bunch of the natives, you know, out on the bank there. But although I knew I was coming to teach in an Indian village, I had never been accustomed to being around them. We had them in North Dakota, but I didn't know much about them.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he says, oh, well, he says, I'd better take you down to the town of the Eagle. He says, you maybe have to go through customs anyhow. Well, he brought me down here, and there was a man on the waterfront, all smiles and nice looking fellow, and he spoke to me, and Percy introduced me, and then he says, oh, he says, we've been looking for you for 2 weeks. And I said, do you happen to have a room at the hotel for me for the night? And he said, sure, I've been waiting for 2 weeks. So that kind of
What was this guy's name?
George Randall.
George Randall.
Yeah. Now they have the Riverside House, they called it at the time.
Yeah, that used to be over where that little house is, down here on the, close to the riverfront, you know, above the old, well, it's down from the old Biederman store, you know, down the road used to come down and around in front. That little, where that little house is there.
Yeah.
Worked up. It was just about in that location, but it was, oh, we got pictures of it here someplace. And it was a two-story building. Downstairs they had a bar and a soft drink place and a restaurant, tables and chairs and stuff.
Well, I rested pretty good that night. The next morning, I inquired about how to get to the village. Well, there was no way of getting there, and you might be able to get a boat from the village to come down and pick you up. But I said, no, I can still walk. And so I got ready to walk. I was told it was 3 miles, and but someone says, you took a good club with you, because sometimes those dogs up there are vicious. And so I hunted around, got a nice club, and carried it with me. I didn't take anything else because I didn't expect to stay at the second just for a short time that evening. So I walked a what seemed a long ways to me, but it wasn't more than about a mile and a half, I guess. And I heard strange voices and strange language. And I thought, oh, there's some of those Indians coming. And sure enough, they came around the bend. There was two young men. And one of them was kind of sober looking, like a chief of some kind. And the other one was jovial, very talkative. Finally, well, we introduced ourselves, you know. And then they said, too, well, you're our new teacher then, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he says, we've been looking for you. And then I could see they were looking at that club I was carrying. And they made some remark in their language to one another, you know, and then pretty soon one of them spoke up and said, what do you carry that club for? I said, well, I was told that I needed the club because the dogs were rather vicious. I said, we wouldn't let the dogs harm you. So that, it all turned out to be. And I got to the village, and the chief was, they were all out on the bank because some little youngster had spotted me coming. They were all out on the bank by the time I got there. And the chief had the key to the schoolhouse, so he said he could show me the place where I was to live and teach. And of course they thought I was going to stay, but still I didn't bring a thing with me, and they even offered me blankets and some clothes and whatnot. I told them I wasn't coming. I was coming back the next day, but I had no food or anything, you know. And I asked one of the boys at the village if he could, and they suggested this fellow because he had a boat. So I asked him if he could bring my groceries and my luggage. He said he would, so I got it all up the next day.
What were your both of your impressions of this country when you first came into it? What did you think of it?
Well, I liked the looks of it because when I was a young fella out there in Warrington, part of the time I'd be up in the hills during the summer at the cattle camp. And they had range, you know, up there in the Cascades, the foothills of the Cascades, And I was used to being in the woods, and wasn't a great deal of difference in the summer than it was outside, only the trees were bigger out there than they are here. And the first evening that I got, when I got here at Eagle that afternoon on the steamboat, why, old Bert was here and my brother come up with me. And so we had the pack boards and loaded up that evening and started out after supper. Well, we got out to, no, the next morning we started out, and we got out to the Summit cabin. And when we got out there, there was Webster, old Jack Webster, and Warren Steele. They had been out at Fox Creek, and we met them on their way back to Eagle. And they had a horse and a sled. No, they had the pack. They had the whole horse packed, and they were going into Eagle. And we were going on out, so we all had something to eat together. And then we kept on going to the 70 mile, and they come back into Eagle. And we got to Crooked Creek, and we got there the next morning. And I remember I had a pack that was pretty heavy. And when I went to put it on after we had breakfast at Crooked Creek, and then we were going to go on to the falls on the 70 mile, which we did. And when I went to get the load, that pack, why, I'd sat down and get my arms through the straps on the pack, and then I'd get up. Well, Frolic said, "Oh, there's no use doing that, Barney." He says, "You, I'll hold it up for you and while you put it on." So he went to put it on. He says, "Oh my gosh," he says, "I can't lift that." He says, "You can't carry this." I said, "Well, I got it this far, and that's 27 or 8 miles." He couldn't see how I could do it. But we put it on, and we went to the falls. Well, we stayed there that afternoon, and that evening we went on to Barney Creek. And we stayed there 2 or 3 days. It had rained and rained and rained, and the 70 mile was up pretty high. And we either had to go up over this, what they call a mud bluff used to be there, or try to go around it, you know, around on the face of it. And I'd done something there that I'd never do again. The water was so high, and that big heavy pack, I had a small axe, and I'd taken cut handholds and footholds in that clay. And I edged myself all the way around with that 70 mile boiling underneath us. And I often think about what a foolish thing I did to get around that mud bluff. It's quite a ways too, but Holy and I made it, and we both often think of it. And then when we got to
his brother Holy,
when we got to up to old Yost place there at Nugget, there's a little trolley goes across there. Well, Ole, when I went across on it first, and then pushed the trolley back to him, and when he come across, why, one of the wheels jumped the cable, and the cable went up in alongside of the keeper, and Don't laugh, Mom. Her equilibrium is gone, and she can't get it for a little bit.
I had too many antibiotics one year. That
stands and holds herself, and she finds out she's up and down.
I'm safe now, I think. Thank you.
You want to go and get me a wheel? Is it going?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when we got there and I got across on that trolley at Nugget, when I got it back to my brother, and then when he come across, he got just about halfway across, and it jumped the wheel on this there. And there he was out there with a cable up inside, alongside of the jammed. We couldn't move it one way or the other. Well, it took quite a little while before we finally, him hanging upside with his legs, his knees over that cable and trying to work with one hand to get that thing up. Boy, that old river was high too, and boiling down along underneath him there. He had quite an experience getting that cable again, you know, on the shiv like it should be.
Yeah.
See, it just was a thing like that up over, you know, and it come down along here, and the pencil here, and this wheel here, see, and the blooming thing, if it had jumped off that way, it'd have went in the water, because it didn't go on two sides, see, but it just went up and over onto the other half, and there they hung at a kind of a dirty angle too, you know, on this air wheel, the shiv that was in it. Yeah. No, that was an awful weak thing, that cable car on that there at Old Yost. I suppose that's in the river by now. Yeah, the posts and stuff, the A-frames at the end, you know, was gone. Bound to be.
It was almost
they
gone.
Were last time we was there. We had to walk. We had to wait it. Yeah. But
what are some of the earliest things you remember about Eagle, Ole?
Well,
some of the people, or some of the way the town was, or
I at first. Coming from the prairies, I felt hemmed in. All these mountains around here. But it didn't take long until I appreciated the mountains too. And as far as the village and the people in the village, they were the finest kind of people. Hardworking, happy, and they were always helping somebody else. They were very fine people. I taught school for 13 consecutive years at Eagle, at the village. And spent much of my time as in nursing, because we had no doctor, no nurse, you know. Of course, I'd had short courses, and that's all I had. But I spent a lot of time doing that, perhaps as much as I did teaching.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget when they called me to help deliver the first baby. I was scared stiff. But things went off pretty well most of the time. And the children were a delight to be working with. They were such sweet little ones, and they couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak Indian, but we compromised, and they learned some of my English, and I learned some of their Indian.
Yeah.
But they were really a nice people.
It sure changed, though, Mom.
Yes, they have changed.
Liquor. Liquor's the big downfall. And there's always some overbearing white man to help him get it. Come on, come on, come on. Yeah, if it wasn't for that way, it'd be a lot different, just like it used to be. There wasn't any liquor to be had. But there was always some white man once in a while that'd make some. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and try to peddle it to them, you know, to make a few dollars. And that's the way they are today, is these overbearing white men. Come on, come on, come on.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's the problem we have today.
Too.
Yeah,
it's everywhere, I guess.
Yeah, a bunch of good for nothing bootleggers.
It seems that they're just not strong enough to really resist and say no.
Nowadays, they're handed out everything to them, and before that, why, they didn't get anything the same as white people. Nobody got anything from the government. You had to make your own. And the same way here in Eagle. The people, it was, everything was formed. And a lot of the old fellas here in the 80s made their living by farming and selling the produce and stuff. And now there's a handout from the government to everybody, and it seems like everybody's lost what pride he ever did have. And it's a change to the worse. Yeah. This used to be a wonderful place. The Indians worked all year round. They worked at whatever they could get to work, in, you know, that the white man had let them work at, or on the steamboat they'd get, and they cut wood for the steamboats and for other people. And in the wintertime they trapped, they got out, and they would be gone for weeks, but they always would come in during Christmas and New Year's, and then back out in their trap lines again. And the same way with white men too. They lived out on the creeks, and during the holidays there was close to 190 people around in Eagle. But when they'd all be gone back out on the creeks, well, there was only just a few. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But everybody was making his own living. Yeah.
And you should see the Christmas gifts under the Christmas tree.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Mostly homemade, you know.
Oh.
Moccasins and all sorts of
things. Yeah, lots of things, all handmade, and awful lot of it. Yeah.
And they have big feasts between New Year's and, or Christmas and New Year's.
Oh, man,
that was an everyday occurrence.
Was it just kind of one big community gathering
for
the holidays?
And,
and the people were so much, there wasn't any of that blasted liquor. Yeah, that's the whole downfall of Alaska, is that blooming booze. Yeah. And it seems like anymore that if you don't drink booze, you don't amount to anything.
You were telling me this morning about there used to be a lot of gardening going on.
Oh, yeah.
In the area.
Well, this little place here, when I first come here, there was wasn't a tree between the river and the foothills here. It was all clean. And every lot in this city was in garden. If you didn't do it yourself, somebody else done it for you. Or they'd pay your taxes to let them put it in for you. The taxes didn't amount to much. A city lot was only about $1, $1.50 a year for the taxes of it. Well, somebody would pay you taxes to let you, if you'd let them.
Still, I'm just moving.
Yeah. If they'd let you farm it. And there was tons and tons of garden truck. Every fall would go down on the last couple of boats in the fall. circle, Fort Yukon, Rampart, and Tananaw, and on down the river. But the steamboat from Eagle, it would only go as far as Tananaw, and then up the Tananaw River to Nenana, and back again to Dawson. But the last boat generally left here in September, from the 20th on up to 25 or 26, that'd be about the latest they'd be through here going to Whitehorse. And they'd take the steamer out at Whitehorse in the fall, as soon as you get it up there. And when a lot of times the people, residents of Eagle, would make a trip outside, why, they'd take that last boat in the fall and go to Whitehorse and Dawson, to Gagway, get on the steamer there, and in the fall, there was always a lot of fish to haul out to Seattle, and these here steamers would be calling in at all these little hidden coves all the way out, where the canneries. And it was real interesting to take the last trip. It'd take you pretty near a month to get there, but you had a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you seen a lot of little places along in the woods where there'd be a cannery and just a few people live. But it was interesting, and you got acquainted with people. And then you'd come back during the winter and take the stage from Dawson, from Whitehorse to Dawson, and from Dawson on down to Eagle with Percy D. Wolfe. But there was most generally a pretty good trail in on the river then, and at that time Fairbanks was a long ways from Eagle, and you had to go down the river, no airplanes those days, and you go down to the circle and then walk to Chattanooga, and then they had an old Model T, kind of a little old truck affair with some seats on it, and that's what you rode into Circle from Chattanooga to Fairbanks. Yeah, guys, that was sure the difference than it is now.
That
an airplane, and in an hour and a half, you're in Fairbanks. Yeah, a lot different. But it was a lot closer for us to go to Dawson, because it's only 104 miles up the river. And in the summertime, you get on the steamer on a trip up, and in a day and a half or so, you was in Dawson. And they'd even load your boat, a small boat, on the bow of the Yukon, the steamer, and take it off for you when you got there. And when you got ready to come down, why, you'd just get in your little boat and drift on that back down home to Eagle. It wouldn't cost you anything. It wouldn't even cost you anything to take the boat up, boy, either.
That was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, now there's no steamboat or anything else goes to Dawson unless you charter a flight or something like that to go to Dawson. Yeah, or you go in your own boat.
Where does that barge go now, that Brainstorm?
Oh, the Brainstorm, well, most of the time it's down here. Yeah, that is out of Fort Yukon, hauling from Fort Yukon to Circle. There's an awful pile of stuff comes to Circle and then down on that Brainstorm to Fort Yukon.
I see.
Yeah, an awful lot of stuff is loaded that way. But you can, it comes up to Dawson. The only time it goes to Dawson, though, is to get stuff for Old Crow. It goes up the Porcupine, you see. And that's quite a little trip up the Porcupine. That's 358 miles from the mouth of it to Old Crow. So it's quite a little jaunt.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful trip. That is the first 100 to 150 miles. It's pretty dull looking because it's just all flat, But ducks and geese in the summer, the air is full of the things, and the hawks and the eagles and those big horned owls, they're honking all day long. I mean, those owls are hooting all day long, and the eagles and the hawks keep those poor ducks and geese in a turmoil. I don't see how they hatch very good.
Hmm.
Yeah, they talk about the eagles and stuff being extinct. They are extinct in Washington, D.C. in New York City because they're not sitting on lampposts where they think there isn't any more. But there's nothing to eat there either. And but here on the Porcupine and on the Yukon, down there in that flat country down there, why, man alive. But there on that Porcupine, the lower reaches of that Porcupine, you never saw so many eagles and hawks and stuff in your life. And there's places out in the Aleutian Islands out there where the eagles are so thick that I believe there's an eagle for every 10 square feet of beach.
That's amazing.
Yeah, just sitting on the beach. Yeah.
Waiting for a duck to run.
Hmm?
Waiting for a duck to
Yeah, walk. Waiting for ducks and those muries and stuff, you know. Those puffins and small
birds.
Small birds. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they give them an awful time. I was surprised the first time I went up that way, but I said it was a pile of hawks and stuff